Okay. I'm going to tell you about work I've been doing, me and a bunch of other people have been doing in Dave Waitz's lab, trying to characterize the mechanical properties of entangled actin networks and also more complicated cross-link and bundled actin networks. And especially the latter, the actin and actin bundling protein networks, is really recent work. So that's stuff that we've just sort of been getting the past couple months. So think about it hard and tell us what you think. And we can do more experiments. And this work is done with a bunch of collaborations. Maria, who's going to talk later about the bulk rheology, is in our group. Jennifer Shin, who does all the imaging, she did this nice EM picture of just an entangled actin network, works with Paul Matsudara at MIT and the Whitehead Institute. And Alois and Megan and Andreas were all working in our lab when the work was done. And John Crocker is a very smart person to know and helps us with some of our techniques, and was a former postdoc as well. So what are we doing? We're developing microrheology, and most of you are here earlier this week. Microrheology is a tool to study mechanical properties with very small sample volumes. Most bulk rheometers typically require about a milliliter of sample. We now can get about 300 microliters of sample. When I do microrheology experiments, it usually only requires 30 microliters, and you can even get that down to 10 microliters of sample. So for either proteins that are precious, expensive, or if you're looking at the rheology of a cell that's very heterogeneous and only, you know, tens of microns across, you can't put it in a bulk rheometer. And we're trying to develop tools to be able to measure it other ways. And a lot of work has been done on one particle, looking at the motions of individual particles and sort of interpreting the response of the particle in the network as the rheology of the surrounding network in an F-actin. And we're sort of trying to understand what this sort of single bead motion means in actin networks. And the other tools that we can use with microrheology is sort of understanding what the microscopic basis is for bulk rheology. We have these individual micron-sized probes in our sample, and we can sort of see how, you know, moduli, you know, a bulk modulus occurs from looking at very small length scales. So that's sort of part of our motivation for doing this. So the actin we're using is a gift from the Zachmann group in Munich. A lot of work has been done with bad actin. We sort of had this gift given to us, and we sort of take it. And it makes my job as a graduate student a lot easier. I don't have to worry about preparing actin all the time. And we know that we're getting good actin from them. So, and we just sort of, it becomes lyophilized, which means it has some sugar packed in it to prevent protein, to make the proteins more stable. And so we dialyze it against free G-buffer, and we sort of use this actin within a couple of days of preparing it. Then what we do is we incubate the beads with the G-actin, the monomeric form of the actin. We put micron-sized beads, and then we initiate the polymerization. And so we have beads in our entangled polymer network. And let's see. Oh, and this is all stuff about reproducibility, which maybe you care about, maybe you don't. But we get really reproducible samples. And so either from prep to prep, like month to month, and also within a day, within day to day, which is very happy, as some of you might know from the actin community. So the technique we're using is multi-particle tracking. Now, if you look very carefully, these beads are moving. And even though it's hard to see by eye, we have very sensitive particle tracking methods that can detect the motions of these particles. These motions are just moving with thermal motion. And we use video microscopy to take videotape, basically, of the thermal motions of these particles. We track all the particles in our field of view. This is sort of a clipped field of view, so we usually get about 100 particles in our field of view. So we can track the motions of 100 particles simultaneously for minutes. You know, I go up to 20 minutes. You can do it for an hour. There's really no limitation. You know, you have 2 hours of videotape. You can just sort of put it under the microscope and just take data as long as you want. We are limited by other, by our time resolution. You know, it's video rate. And there's no reason we can't go to faster cameras. But right now we're just doing video microscopy. And our spatial resolution is about 10 nanometers, a little bit better than 10 nanometers. So it's a little bit worse than laser tracking methods, but it's very good. How do we get 10 nanometers? We know that these scatterers are spherical, yeah. So we convolve a two-dimensional Gaussian over the brightness profile. We do frame by frame. Yeah. So, and a particle.
Do you actually illuminate, do you pass illumination at the same time?
We don't do that, but what? So they're moving quickly, they could smear.
And it smears?
Mm-hmm, it could smear slightly.
It's not clear that you can paint 10 nanometers in terms of knowing where it is.
Well, the average position maybe.
Well, 10 nanometers, it's sort of a smear over. There have been lots of artifacts in the acting.
I think it needs to move relatively slowly because they're big beads.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that's not an issue with these experiments.
The principle
of this.
But in a 30th of a second, it's moving.
Yeah. How long
they don't move very much. We checked the eccentric, I mean.
They move 100 nanometers.
No.
How long does it take to diffuse a 3D?
No. And oh, we also use a fast shutter time, so we do. We use a shutter time. We do use a shutter time, so we don't flip the illumination, but we use a really quick shutter time with our CCD camera.
Okay, that was the question.
Okay, sorry. There's other people that do strobe, but we don't do that.
What is the shutter?
What is it's like 1/1000th of a second. Yes. We use a quick shutter time. We're looking at big beads. We use bright, so we can just image them with bright field. I've sort of seen weird effects with using fluorescence to track beads, so I sort of like to stay in bright field. Basically, what happens is that in the fluorescently dyed particles, imaging with fluorescence, what it looks like is a hole is sort of burned in the network. So you can image a bead in bright field, it moves a little bit. You image the same field of view in with fluorescence, it moves a lot more, and you turn off fluorescence, and the bead still moves a lot. It's a little weird. So, yeah, but these are high-level fluorescence, and we haven't really done much to sort of minimize that, and we could. But I can do bright field, so why not? And we can track these particles in actin. I mean, these motions, I don't know if I can play the movie again. This is a typical 1 mg/mL actin solution. So the particles stay in the field of view for an hour, you know? They don't move in and out of the field of view. So the idea behind one particle microrheology is you look at the thermal motion of a bead, and then you can measure the mean square displacement, and you can interpret that as elastic and loss moduli. Now, what has been seen is that this is the elastic and loss moduli you get from one particle microrheology, and it underestimates the bulk rheology at most frequency ranges. And also the frequency dependence is very different. So there's been a lot of studies into understanding why is there this discrepancy. And it's sort of unfortunate because we want to use microrheology as a tool to probe the mechanical properties of the networks. Yes?
Can I ask about those studies? Does this discrepancy arrive just in biopolymers like actin, or to what extent has the microrheology mm-hmm. been trialed with standard polymer?
With flexible polymer networks, with flexible polymer networks, the reproducibility is excellent. It matches on over the bulk rheology fantastically.
Okay, like what?
Like PEO.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, even that's a bit troublesome, actually. What about polystyrene?
I think it, no.
It's all in acres.
We tried to do some non-aqueous particle, but we were doing it with scattering, and it's tough to get the beads that will scatter. What would be really nice is to do it now.
Well, it wouldn't move.
Well, maybe we should discuss this later, because in fact there's some issues in entangled solution rheology where it would be absolutely, with Gary Lee and Kanchi Nahar here, it would be absolutely fabulous to discuss what might be done with some monodisperse polysolutions that are very well.
This discrepancy shouldn't be
there.
It does seem to be special for the really original.
Well, let me just say that as far as I'm concerned, where I think you run into problems is you put cross links in.
No, cross links.
If it's not cross linked, it seems to work really well.
So one other thing worried you was when you said that I can see why you do this. You clearly have to polymerize in situ the beads there.
Yeah.
But how do you know?
That's my next slide. So, yeah, I mean, the gel is stiff. So how would you, I mean, you're either ripping it by putting the beads in afterwards, which really does funky things to the gel, or you have to polymerize around the beads. So you really have to be concerned about the microenvironment of the bead. So in the ideal microrheology experiment, you'd have perfect coupling from the bead in the network. And then your thermal undulations in your network would be reported in the thermal fluctuations of the bead. However, with semi-flexible polymers, there's thought to be this depletion layer of polymer around the bead. Also, you can change the surface chemistry of the bead. So either the polymer sort of sticks to the bead, and there might be a local modulus that's stiffer than your actual bulk modulus. Also, if your bead size, if it's a new system, you don't quite know the mesh size of your network, your bead motion might be slipping through the network. And or if you have a very heterogeneous media, some beads might be slipping through the network, some beads might be stuck. So these are all problems with interpreting one particle microrheology results that need to be solved. And sort of it depends, it's a system-to-system variation. So what do we do? We want a technique that's sort of independent of bead size, bead surface chemistry, you know, depletion layer effects, and this technique is two-particle microrheology. And what this technique does is you look at the correlated motions of beads across your fields of view. So instead of looking at thermal motion of each individual particle, you're looking at the correlated motion. And in this, you're in a coarse-grained continuum limit of your material. And you can tell that you're in this limit by looking for the 1 over R dependence of the correlated motion between these two tracers. And we check this. We can only use this technique if we check this. So, I mean, and we check this for every different times and for many different bead separations. I typically go up to about 100 microns separations of beads. And I make sure to focus into my field of view about 150 microns. I can only look at correlated motion as far as I'm focused into the field of view. And from this correlated motion, we want to compare it to what our results are from one particle microrheology. So we sort of make a quantity that's similar to the individual mean square displacement. We call it the distinct mean square displacement. And it just scales by, you know, the distance between the two beads you're correlating and the bead size.
What distance do you run into noise for at the highest
frequency? I can show you data later. With the stiffer samples, the noise floor, I don't see it at all in the entangled actin, but when I go to the stiffer samples, I see this at like 60 microns actually sometimes. So what he's asking is I do actually see the resolution limit of our particle tracking techniques. And I see it sometimes the correlated motion is just a plateau at very long distances, which is kind of cool. But so what do we get?
Drift or something else?
Drift actually, what drift does is sort of makes all the correlated motions really just sweep up into constant. So it doesn't, you don't see 1 over R decay and then a plateau.
That's what I mean. So the floor you're talking about is probably primarily drift.
Oh, high frequency floor, yeah. You see the loss down with frequency, so.
Drift would be overall your entire field of view, right?
Yeah, I guess when I said, or long wavelength fluctuation.
Okay. I mean, it's right at our resolution limit.
Yeah, it's a resolution limit.
Yeah. So what do we see? I showed you this discrepancy between the bulk data, which is shown in black. I'm sorry, this is the darker spots are the elastic modulus. The open is the loss modulus, and this is the one particle results in that weird line. And this is the two particle results. Sorry, they're not aligned properly. This is a slope of half over over our frequencies, and also you can see that the elastic modulus, I mean, the two-point matches the bulk data. It overlays exactly. So both in the frequency dependence and in the magnitude at the frequencies we're probing. So, what?
Quite.
Not quite exactly. It's very, very good agreement.
What limits the high frequency
that you can reach? We're limited by video rate. Yeah. But in principle, I mean, Christoph's been doing work to look at much higher frequencies with laser tracking methods. So
this is done in your own rheometer with a paper column?
No, this is done with the Zachman rheometer, but it's the same actin. So
the agreement's better than the reproducibility experiment.
Exactly.
So yeah, it's definitely within the reproducibility of two actin measurements.
And it wouldn't tend to believe the loss modulus compared to the storage modulus. I always believe the dominant term in microrheology measurements.
And we've done this, just so you don't think I'm crazy, with one concentration. We've done this for another concentration and compared it to other bulk data. And this also, the two-point data matches onto the bulk very well. Yeah?
Do you measure bulk
We get one from the other. Mm-hmm.
Is that 0.3 milligrams per
liter? Yes, 0.3. Oh, yeah, sorry, the title is wrong. Yeah?
The two particle is the average of correlation between many pairs, is that right?
Yes.
So there's both time average and ensemble average.
Yes, it's a tensor product. Yeah. It's in three dimensions. So one is the distances between your beads, and one is time. One axis is time.
Right.
Yeah.
You should have a lot of averaging here.
There's a lot of averaging.
So why
over
still relatively large noise in this?
Because your correlated motions are really small. Mm-hmm. I mean, and basically any motion, the motions are very small. So I think, what is it? You're trying to subtract, you're subtracting two big numbers to get a small number. And so your noise is big.
Can I just ask another any question which is to do with the how high you could push the modulus of these things and still get taken off?
Mm-hmm. In our, yep. So our technique, yep, yep.
Does that limit high frequencies or low frequencies?
It limits either. We're limited by our resolution of our particle tracking routine and that, so that the accuracy which we can find centers and the bead size that we use. With these bead sizes and our accuracy, we can go to about 100 pascal, between 10 and 100.
Does the laser tracking method
go higher because you have better resolution? Mm-hmm.
People study the many body effect in this. I mean, you're
so higher correlated, like three body?
Yeah, I mean, you were saying
no,
it turns out
not yet.
Independent, but
mm-hmm.
I think there's
yes.
another one.
Yeah. Yes.
Maybe
no.
Also makes some
it might. Yeah.
Okay. Why don't study just two?
Two beads?
Yeah.
That's what Christoph does. We have problems studying two beads because we need a lot of time points. I mean, we only have 30 frames a second. So so we make up for that by having a lot of different averaging over a lot of different pairs of points. And also we need to check for. I mean, you have to check for the 1/r decay.
I mean, when you get the G-prime jump, I mean, you still this fitting to the structural format. So
yes, yeah, it's the same exact, yeah.
The smoothness of this curve is not really representative of the
data. No, it's not. It's a smooth curve.
Yeah. It's really important to realize when you talk about...
It doesn't change the magnitude so much, but it changes the curvature. So
the smoothness of the curve, I mean,
yes.
Smooth,
no, exactly. This data is smooth. But if you look, but you wouldn't believe if I went back here that you'd really want to look at all the curvature of all that noisy data. Yeah, exactly. But it is smooth data.
But because you're transforming from one to get another,
mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, they would.
Potentially, you're going to do these artifacts.
Yeah.
Are you using a straight Kramer's Kroning integral, or are you using Tom Mason's?
We're using Tom Mason's
approximation.
Yes. Yes. Okay, so we're sort of interested in understanding how this single bead motion and the correlated bead motion varies with both bead surface chemistry, bead size, and actin concentration. So sort of testing our one particle and two particle results with all these variations. And the first thing, so the bead surface chemistry affects your results because either you have proteins that are sort of binding to your actin, binding to your bead surface and changing the local modulus that your bead might feel. So we use three different, these are all in, now we can, the techniques we use first are ones that make our beads more inert. So carboxylate beads, carboxyl groups are very active with biological proteins. We can either coat the carboxyl beads with BSA, which absorbs onto the surface of the bead, and or we can graft little short peg chains onto the surface of our bead. And both of these make the beads more inert to protein binding. And what we find in the one particle mean square displacement is that our curves shift up, noticeably. And then, so there is a change in the local modulus you feel due to protein binding when you use carboxylate beads. And then when you look at the correlated motions between your beads, these differences between the two bead surface chemistries disappear. So two-point is really bead surface chemistry independent of bead surface chemistry. So even though you're changing the local modulus of your bead, the correlated motions of your beads is does not change, which is good.
So it's the mean squared displacement shifts
higher. The mean squared, so the bead is moving more when it, the polymers are not sticking to it.
It's interesting to note the discrepancy seems to go away at short times.
Well, I think actually, I think the slope is changing. If you look at it, yeah.
Just amplitude.
Mm-hmm. The discrepancy, yeah.
I sort of expect that.
Mm-hmm.
It's increasingly, it should be less sensitive to exactly what's attached or not attached to the surface because it's hydrodynamically coupling to all the surrounding filaments more strongly as you go to higher frequencies. Is that?
That's the other way.
No. Time.
Yeah.
No, I know.
But that doesn't make any sense when we talk about what the slope should be. I mean, don't we have all those questions about what the slope should be at those really short times?
Is this something you see routinely with this?
I wouldn't read too much into it.
Okay.
I would say that every data that I've ever seen, if it goes to a lower value at long time, it's gone to a lower value at short time. And this is a discussion I've had with Margaret, but that's, I think, every piece of data I've ever seen.
Right, but the question is this apparent convergence just coincidence here, or is this something that you see routinely? The value may be lower, but it looks like it's converging.
I wouldn't believe it. The video data.
I wouldn't.
To say.
Yeah, I would do nothing else.
Evolution.
Yeah.
You can do other techniques to measure.
I would wholeheartedly agree. I'm mostly looking. I'm mostly interested in sort of, these timescales. You know, I wouldn't read too much into those last two data points. I'd have to analyze my data more carefully, and that's why I sort of drew two lines, sort of indicating a difference in slope, but it's not the highlight.
Which one is expected to adhere to the...
The carboxylate beads.
Which one?
So it moves less because there's some protein binding to the surface. And actually, when we use carboxylate beads using other biopolymer networks, the networks don't even form. I mean, the carboxylate beads, you know, cross-link the gel so much that they just sort of precipitate out of solution. So we sort of are sort of exclusively using these PEG-coated beads that Megan developed, and we find these have very good protein resistance. If we do try to make sticky beads, so this is sort of an interesting idea of, you know, making a bead that so the one-particle microrheology really matches two-particle in bulk. I sort of have problems. I haven't tried it so hard, but you know, your beads aggregate all together. You see these nice nucleation of the actin filaments, and here's your one particle motions. So it's sort of more in the limit where you'd see bulk. It's more like bulk behavior. This curve, if you transform it into a modulus, actually overestimates the bulk modulus and does not replicate the frequency dependence that you see with two particle. So I don't know. I get nervous about using sticky beads simply because I don't know what other effects I'm having on the gel or what cross-linkers I'm adding. And it's hard to do it in a controlled manner. So now we're using, for these actin studies, this is sort of before we sort of looking at surface chemistry very carefully. I'm using carboxylate beads, but we find these don't stick a lot, but they do stick slightly. So you should, for the people who care, this is something you should take into consideration when you're looking at the one particle bead motions. The first study I do is I change the bead size and with the same actin concentration. And this mean squared displacement of the bead motions is scaled by the particle size. And you can see over a wide variety of bead sizes, all the individual bead motions fall on top of each other. This is when the mean squared displacement is scaled by particle size, which is how you should expect the modulus to go, which suggests that you're measuring a local modulus with these slightly sticky beads. And however, if you make a bead small enough, you see completely different behavior. And this is a mesh size about 0.3, and these are 0.46 micron in diameter beads. And I think the local modulus we measured with these 1-point beads is about, you know, a tenth of a pascal, which is actually sort of similar to the low frequency limit of bulk rheology. This is sort of a cute thing. These are for the small beads compared to the mesh size. you can actually tune the slope of your mean square displacement based on how what your mesh size is proportional to your bead size. So this is keeping the bead size constant and changing the mesh size of your network all the way from, this is 2 megs per mil, all the way down to 0.15 megs per mil. And you can tune it from 0 to 1. and so we're sort of studying this more, and we're looking at, and so what do we see? We can actually go in and look at the actual video. And why isn't this playing? There we go. Okay, so what we see, you can actually see the video here, is that beads are stuck, and then they sort of jump through the network. And they're stuck for a while, jump back. And so they're sort of slipping through the mesh, but there's a waiting time that you're actually measuring with the motion of the beads. And this is the actual particle trajectory at x, the x position as a function of time. So it's jiggling around a hole, jumping, jiggling around a hole. And this is an xy track of what a small bead looks like in the same concentration of actin as a big bead. So if you
so when you said you tune the slope, I mean, that's a little disingenuous in the sense that there isn't a power law scaling of a delta square root at all, because there's
when you ensemble average over 150 beads, there is.
You're crossing over between two linear.
That's true, but I guess we're interested in why, what's causing that change.
No, I don't think you are.
I didn't say that.
Between two diffusion coefficients. That's not what it is at all. I mean, I think that she's going to tell you it's one diffusion coefficient with the possibility of moving
through the network.
But there is one way of getting a variable power law, which is to say that there are traps.
Exactly. And that's what we sort of. Yeah. Exactly. So that's what we're analyzing. I don't have that with me. So we're analyzing what we.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The second diffusion coefficient is so fast that it's instantaneous jump. And the question is just how long it waits before it jumps. So it's really different physics in a crossover between two diffusion coefficients.
We change concentration.
To change concentration, you also expect a crossover in roughly the same window between two different regimes anyway.
Yeah.
Between a plateau and
If you use a bigger bead size, you don't.
I disagree with that. You go from when the bead is really small compared to the mesh, you have one diffusion coefficient, that's like a pre-diffusion, you're slightly constrained. When it's large compared to the mesh, or even comparable compared to the mesh, then you have different physics. You have something where it's sensing the mesh, something where it jumps and senses the mesh, something where it jumps and senses the mesh. That becomes physics that I think we're seeing.
If you go to bigger particles or higher concentrations, you also expect another crossover.
But that physics itself splits into at least two different universality quantities. One in which the distribution of trap times is narrow enough to give you a well-defined mean hopping time, in which case you do recover ordinary diffusion.
Mm-hmm.
And I think diffusion with a slow diffusion constant. Yes, no argument. Another case in which the tails of the trap distribution are wide enough or give you there's range properties there which will induce an effective power displacement, non-linear displacement. I haven't seen data out to time long enough which would really convince me that either of those is.
Well, what we're doing is analyze the waiting times within these pores, and we look at the distribution, the probability distribution of these waiting times, and we see a power law that's consistent.
Okay.
So we see a power law of -1.3, and the slope here is about 0.3. So, but this is work in progress, so.
What's the point of dispersity of those beads? It's a polystyrene from.
It's from molecular probes. Small. Bead size, yeah.
Well, you don't have to vary it much.
But the mesh size, the variations in the mesh size are much bigger than the polydispersity, I would imagine.
Yeah. Exactly. When I did this a while ago, I basically saw straight lines for.
But you were looking at individual beads. So some of our beads, the diffusion is, it's basically a straight line, and the beads that are stuck.
Yeah.
you know, this distance between the waiting times is so much bigger than our jiggling that it pulls up the mean square displacement of those beads.
There's a minute between the jumps there, so I don't know whether you're taking
a minute. No? Yeah. Okay.
This was like also the video, like where I had my So they were straight lines, but of course, you know, pretty rugged, so
Can we do the same with long chains instead of beads?
Long chains instead of beads. What do you mean? Track long chains instead of beads? We could?
I mean, because they have kind of a bundle of coil, and then kind of see how they jump from one chain to the other.
We could. I think, I mean,
flexible foam.
Okay,
so you put other.
Tracer, yes, you could. And I think, I mean, there have been some attempts to do that, or some people think about doing that.
Explain what you did in that bottom right curve.
Oh, okay, sorry, I forgot about that. So so this is where you have a, beads, you have a full ensemble, 100 beads in your field of view, and you know about 20% of them are jumping, right? If you take away all the jumps in those tracks, your mean square displacement, you know, pulls down and matches up right on top of all the other, you know, one particle mean square displacements. So that really also suggests more that when you're not slipping through the network, you really are measuring a local modulus with one particle microrheology. And what happens when we have the effect of bead size with two particle microrheology? Does it get rid of these differences? So this is the first, the top three curves are three different bead sizes where I've taken out of the jumps the half micron beads. And the two particle data is actually, I didn't take out the jumps when I did the two particle data, which doesn't come up so clear in this graph. But I didn't take out the jumps. And when you look at the correlated motion of your beads, the your half micron beads actually match up with your bigger beads. So you can even use small beads that are sort of slipping through the network to do two particle microrheology, which is sort of exciting.
The bottom curves are matching up better than the top.
They're not matching up better, but this is you have three different bead sizes, and they all sort of reproduce the bulk behavior.
More than the curves on top.
No, the curves on top don't reproduce the bulk behavior. That's one particle microrheology. So this, the blue curve is what I showed that matches the bulk data at the beginning. And what I'm saying is that you can use different bead sizes and get the same results.
Can you explain why at early times in two particle rheology gives actually a smaller displacement for the smaller beads rather than a larger one?
Yeah, I don't know.
Is it noise?
Yeah, I haven't thought about that.
Did you do this ensemble correction method for all different bead sizes, where you take all those who jump?
Yeah, this graph is not so good. But I, for using the half micron beads, I did not take out the jumps. So that's why that data is a little bit noisier than the other two data. That you have some beads that motions are much bigger. So when you subtract these huge motions, you get even a little bit noisier data. Yeah, I haven't thought about that. I don't really look at the data. I don't really trust the data down here so much. So.
Margaret?
Yes?
How come for the two particles you didn't take out the jumps?
Just because I wanted to show that you could have a bead size that was sort of smaller than your mesh size of your network. And so if, even if it moves to the network, you can still look at the correlated motion and get the bulk behavior. Make sense? Yeah. Yeah. That's not a stupid question at all. Yeah. it's between, I look for the one over RDK, so I see this between usually 7 microns and about 100 microns.
Now here comes a stupid question.
Yeah?
If you use single particles,
yeah.
Size,
yeah.
Typical distance between two particles and two particle microbiology.
Yeah.
You then get consistent results, and it's just they're going to the continuum limit, right?
Yeah, so when you do, when you make your bead size, let me think about how to answer this. If you make your if you make your filaments shorter compared to your bead size, when they become small compared to your bead size, you your one particle microbiology for actin networks reproduces bulk behavior. That's not the question you're asking. You're asking about big beads at small distances. Let's see.
I think the answer is A, I don't think we know for sure. But there are two things that suggest that you may not get the same thing. First are these extraneous effects, depletion regions, sticking to the bead, and all these sort of details that are absolutely important, but you don't have experimental control over, which is the nice thing that she showed that two-particle microbiology just totally ignores because you're looking at the correlative motion. That's one thing that people, but let's say you could avoid that. Then I hope she'll come to explaining, she doesn't, David Morse will get up or Tony Knight will get up and explain why one particle really is giving something qualitatively different than two particles, it seems, and yet is in the end giving something sensible.
To a point, if the beads are very large, it should be the same.
It's
only saying 10 microns should be enough.
But no, you asked a slightly different question.
You did.
What are the same
beads? No, you're looking at for separation distances for big beads.
Equal to the same.
Yeah.
Is one going to be better? And I think the answer is that the 2-point is better because as you scale up the bead size, you're also increasing the steric depletion rate around these particles. And in a sense, the ideal thing would be to go to small beads separated at a large distance because their correlative motion still probes that larger scale without producing these big depletion.
That's a good point.
So I think it's actually
That's a good point. 1 micron, typically. I use 2 micron for the one particle microbiology, but all the data I show is 1 micron and below. So the last thing I'll talk about with the entangled actin networks is sort of the effect of concentration dependence. So I showed you data from one particle microbiology that showed a bunch of different bead sizes overlapping for one concentration, and I suggested that this is measuring a local modulus. So this is that data, and then we can do it for several different concentrations and show that even at different concentrations, different bead sizes still overlap when you scale them by the bead size. Oh, this should be times A. And so it really does suggest that you're measuring a local modulus with your one particle microbiology, but it just isn't the same thing as your bulk modulus. And we can see how this local modulus scales with concentration, and it follows the power law of 1.8, which is slightly increased from what you'd predict from theory for semi-flexible polymers, which is, I think, 1.4. But sort of an enhanced power law can be explained by having a small number of cross-linkers in your system. And if we look at two-particle results for different concentrations, we start to see a bend over in the two-particle mean square displacement at long times. It's hard to get data at very long times, but you know, for the higher concentrations, you start to see the slope of 0.5 bend over into a plateau modulus. And we can scale this plateau modulus also as concentration, and we also see a power law of 1.8, which is the same power law we saw with our one particle displacements. Yeah?
Do you think there might be some problem?
I mean, I think that it's sort of inherent. I mean,
It's not actually an increase in modulus much above what you'd expect for.
No, it's not.
It's a little hard to see how they.
But I mean, this is the same. I think any actin might have some inherent cross-linkers.
It's a little hard to see how the power law could increase.
But I mean, also, if you look at sort of this curve, so this is sort of matching on the two-particle and one-particle. This is a slope of the theory prediction. I mean, so if you want to, I mean, how different it is, it's sort of.
Yeah, Zachman took his macroscopic data.
Yeah.
In the 98 paper, they put a line of 1.4 through it.
Yeah.
But they knew what they were looking for.
Okay, yeah. So, the fit to the data is 1.8, but the slope of 1.4 is sort of mildly negligible. But the interesting thing here is that, why are you frowning at me?
I think about the data. You threw away the top point, Margaret.
Yeah.
Then that slope looks pretty good.
Then
the one part.
If we throw away data. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Four.
Yeah, it's very. Yeah, it's not. It's hard to tell.
Put a plus minus on it, I think it's going to come.
I want to have my own power law. I have to have my own power law. Everybody else has their own power law. So the point here is actually, power law aside, is that your plateau modulus that you're measuring with one point microrheology is sort of the same, is a little bit under what you measure with two particle microrheology and bulk rheology. So, yeah.
Is that only true when the beads are small enough so that they're not?
Yes. So in this data, exactly. So in this data, I for the low concentrations when there is jumping for all of our bead sizes, I take out those jumps. Yeah. Thanks for asking. So that's sort of interesting.
Consistent with the fact that the frequency dependence also would appear to be the same.
Of?
In the two techniques.
Frequency dependence, this is plateau modulus. So the frequency dependence is very different.
Except in the plateau.
It's flat. In the plateau where it's flat.
Yeah. I just meant that the experiments that have been done out at higher frequencies than you go with video.
Yes.
Also seem to see agreement of the two techniques in slope, but not in magnitude. That was my
point. Okay.
I don't think there is any. There is no high frequency data available with
that.
Well, it agrees with the theory, but there isn't any valid data.
I sort of skipped ahead. So the other cool thing with this technique is that we can measure, this is a sort of a novel, two-point microrheology sort of serves as a way to measure Poisson ratio. We can look at the longitudinal correlation of our beads and the transverse correlated motion of our beads. So this is sort of cool. And so we can compare these two correlated motions and extract a Poisson ratio for our system. And over our frequency ranges, we see an incompressible network. And we'd expect that because we're sort of looking at long distances. We're not looking at things at the length scale of the bead.
You didn't separate between beads far apart and close together?
It's all 1 over R. So we extract back down from the long bead sizes, right? So this is all.
You would sort of expect the Poisson ratio to change for small distances.
It might deviate.
So if you select only, you haven't tried selecting only.
Yeah, I haven't done that. Yeah, it might. It might change. That could be sort of interesting.
So there was a comment from Tony that David Morse had some idea of how this was supposed to deviate.
The Poisson ratio?
Yeah.
No. Isn't this linked with the, you'd expect the very low frequencies that this should be linked to the osmotic?
Yeah,
so
the Poisson ratio is probably more than that.
And you say that you speak osmotic compressibility is zero, so the Poisson ratio is no longer a half. Am I completely messing everything up?
No, it's.
Zero incompressible. It's a half.
No, zero bulk modulus, zero 3D modulus.
Zero compressibility.
You mean zero modulus.
Yeah, zero modulus. Sorry.
I don't know. I've not thought about it.
Here. But it should go below this curve, at low frequency,
principle. But with the radius
limitation. But this, I mean, you could sort of think about measuring, I mean, it's neat for the active networks, but we can also measure this Poisson ratio in gels, which actually I'm going to talk about very soon, and also maybe two-dimensional systems. You know, you can measure the Poisson ratio in all sorts of cool things that you weren't able to before. All right, so the conclusions, this is all entangled actin. The two-particle microrheology reproduces the bulk frequency-dependent moduli. It eliminates differences of one-particle microrheology with bead surface chemistry, size. And when the bead size is sort of similar to the mesh size, the beads give the bead motions sort of are slipping through the network and give additional information about the microstructure of the network. And these both one particle and two particle sort of scale with concentration in the same way. But the thing that's is confusing, which we think we understand, which is Dave was alluding to, which I'm not going to talk about, which Tony is free to talk about if he wants to, is we sort of understand why the plateau modulus we're measuring with one particle and two particle is the zero frequency elastic modulus. So, and why the frequency dependence might be different for one particle and two particle. Zero, the plateau modulus, the low frequency limit. So I have no idea what time it is. I'm hoping that it's not grossly late.
In fact, I think there is an argument that seems to 1.8.
Oh. Well, then I'll get a parallel of
1.85. Can I ask?
Yeah.
Question,
yeah, please.
I'm so familiar with the formulas behind this one and the particle.
Yeah.
Just,
yeah.
In the beginning, you had this plot where you showed sort of these converted data for geomolecules.
Yep.
And they did not agree.
Yep.
And, that was, it was always sort of, you had data from the same time frame.
Yep.
Obtained from these different
techniques.
And then later on, you showed the actual. Fluctuations, or means the displacement of particles or the relative and in that case you had the single particles already converged, they were already seeing their kink, while the two particles did not, they were still sort of exploring it, and the plateau for that thing was now I wonder if you just, if you convert that to a modulus just in the time domain and you completely forget about that there's also sort of this size dependence, how that is possible. I mean, is that somewhere in this?
If that was a stupid question, I'm scared about your smart questions. So the formalism we use to convert the mean square displacement of the beads into modulus is the same for both one particle and two particle microrheology. So I sort of prefer, but let's see.
I mean, naively, if you measure, let's say, a G of omega, that's what.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I think there's something like G of omega and K, which depends on the length scale, right?
Yes.
For example, if you want to see the asymptotic modulus, which is limiting the maximum relative fluctuation of beads.
Yes.
And of course, the time it needs for this, it will depend on the length scale where you're doing this.
Yeah. And that is your length scale of your bead. That's
what you really measure. Is a mean square displacement. You measure motion. The assumption that's inherent in what Margaret uses to convert the mean square displacement into a modulus is that the motion of the bead is somehow reflecting the average, whatever fluctuation of some homogeneous mean. In this case, a single bead is sensing a lot of details of the motion that really reflect themselves differently on the motion of the bead than if I do this to the whole bead. By contrast, the only way you can get coupling between beads that are far apart is if I have some long wavelength fluctuation of everything. And that's the same thing as doing this. And that's why the motion, the correlated motion of these things, is just measuring some long wavelength fluctuation. It's the same thing with this, it's just thermally excited. That's why that really does give, I think, the modulus. The other thing is probing something where there's some details of the physics that are on the length scale of the bead that are different than what you could ever see if you do some long wavelength excitation that you can do.
But I think our last question was more about the time dependence. If one is already saturated, the other one is still creeping up.
Yeah.
Right. And, well, okay.
If you convert it, then I just don't understand it. I mean, I get 2 points, right? And now I take 2 points which are, let's say, close together or very far apart. Never mind if you can measure it or not. Then I would naively think to reach the asymptotic behavior, which has to correspond to the shear model. It takes much longer if the distance between these 2 points is much further apart. Is that true? I mean, to just see the relative motion saturate.
You worry about retardation, your retardation effect?
No.
Transmitting the information across the network.
No, look, really simple reason. I think what you're asking is why is, if you, let's just go back to what you really measured. That's the mean square displacement, okay? And what you're worried about is that if something's moving really fast, if you're looking at some single particle, it's moved a lot more at shorter times.
Is that what you're asking?
Wrong.
No.
That's okay. Tell me if this helps. Just the if you assume that you've got a homogeneous medium whose response is completely local, k dependent, then you get a 1 over r dependence for the magnitude of this correlation. So she doesn't take data unless she sees a 1 over r dependence, meaning that she's already reached the continuum limit.
Okay, then my question is,
why does a 1 point, yeah.
If I vary the distance, how long do I have to wait until I see the asymptotic maximal relative fluctuations of these 2 points?
When you, I think the answer is whenever you see 1 over r, you've reached asymptotic.
No, it's time. But mean squared displacements, when do the mean squared displacements saturate as a function of the distance of these 2 particles? Because, I mean, that's what you was.
No, the mean squared displacements at a given time reflect the viscoelastic drop in the continuum limit as a function of separation. The mean squared displacements in time reflect the time-dependent viscoelastic properties of the media. So that, whereas...
Right. So there's a dispersion relation between the wave length and the time
scale. Yeah, that's what, yeah.
Yeah.
And what is it?
And it's one of our business, actually, maybe translating slightly, correct question. Depends on what time you're looking, because you could indeed get different crossover times.
That's true.
And so, what time do you look for the 1 over r?
I look at all times.
So it's always 1 over r.
It always, yes.
Each frequency is 1 over r.
I check for the 1 over r. That's what I showed, that first graph where I showed for different times. I mean, you have to check that for each time separation.
It would be very interesting to see if there is some variation, but you're saying there is not.
In the actin, I have not noticed
a very long time, so, because then you would sample the very long wavelength fluctuations even with a single mean. So in that sense, it should be the same mean squared displacement as you get into a mean.
Do you look at several times or every time? Got at your longest lag time?
Yes. Yes.
But then it should become R.
Should we
okay.
Can we
Yeah, I don't know. So it's like 11:30 now. Should we just? I should really quickly. Okay. All right. So basically, yeah. No, that yeah.
Which is if you take a two-particle correlation and you restrict your sampling to a particular distance.
Yeah.
Say R.
Yep.
And you let that distance tend to zero.
Yep.
Do you recover the one particle?
No, that's what two particle is.
It was the geometry of the particles. You know, it's never exactly the one particle.
No, but that's what.
Even when they're right next door.
We don't see one of our right next door. So we look at
you wouldn't
exactly.
See right next door.
Yes.
But if you asked what you ever take raw data.
Yeah.
Would that raw data look more like the one particle?
No. I wouldn't think so. But I think that the thing is those are really interesting questions, which we're trying to figure out why the one particle, what the one particle modulus is really measuring. I mean, it's really sort of the crux of our interest. But what?
It's possible there are some very slow modes, if one thinks of longitudinal gel modes and does a quick estimate of how slow they should go. One could easily estimate minutes for the separations that we're using. So there may be things which are extraordinarily slow getting...
From what? What would the slow modes be from?
From
sloshing.
Local variations in density. So those modes would go very, very slowly in these systems, not so soft.
I see. And why is that? Why? So if you're probing those frequencies. But that was for a small bead size.
For 1 micron.
Yeah, for 1 micron bead. We're looking at long distances. Yeah.
But this was coming from the question, how close can you put them together?
I don't know.
Put the one bead
diameter, yeah, it might be. Yeah. But we're looking at between like 10 microns and 100 microns. So hopefully this last set of data will be sort of eye candy, and it will go a little quicker. Basically, what we're doing is adding actin binding proteins to our networks to change the structure and filament properties. And the one we started using with was a bundling protein, screwin. Screwin is a sort of compact actin binding protein that has two actin binding sites, and they tend to align the filaments together. And so you form in a high amount of screwin, you form really big bundles. In nature, screwin is found in actually the horseshoe crab sperm, and as soon as the sperm approaches the egg and touches it, the sperm releases this coil of about 120 actin filaments all coiled together and mechanically penetrates the egg. And so that's where this actin binding protein is found, but we also see that it forms gels, and we're measuring the mechanical properties and the structure of these gels. So why are we interested in doing this? There are lots of actin binding proteins found in nature. They're involved in cell motility. Semi-flexible and tangled polymer networks are rarely found in nature. It's also a new material. This is a lot of people doing this, and we sort of do three different things to sort of characterize these networks. We do a lot of imaging, which Jennifer from MIT does. She does confocal imaging and EM, and we also do multi-particle tracking on these networks, and we also do bulk rheology, which Maria is going to talk about in just a second. So one particle microrheology, single bead motions. The beads here, even though we coat them with BSA, are very sticky to the networks. They stick a lot. So when we increase the amount of screwin into our increasing amount of screwin, the bead motions are decreased for the same actin concentration. So increase the ratio of actin to screwin, and the bead motions decrease. If we coat them with PEG, so the PEG are the very chemically inert protein-resistant beads, they're very unsticky. Increasing the amount of bundling protein here, the bead motions actually stay about the same, and then they increase. So this is an opposite effect, just using different bead surface chemistries. And how do we explain this sort of increase in bead motion as you increase the amount of bundling protein? Well, these are the spatial trajectories we see with our beads. This is a low amount of screwin, and this is a higher amount. You can see that there are some beads that the bead motion is really small, it's really constrained, but there are other ones that are just probing large environments, and it's very heterogeneous. So that sort of increase in our ensemble average mean square displacement is sort of dominated by these beads that are moving the most. We're getting bigger holes because it's bundling. Yeah, exactly. So, and this is a sort of confocal image we can get by fluorescently labeling these networks. So with low amounts of screwin, you can see thin filaments and thin bundles form in your network. And these are beads you have. And then as you increase the amount of bundling protein, sort of you get these thick bundles and large spaces where there's no background actin network. And yeah?
These are definitely cross-linked in the left.
These are cross-linked as well.
What sort of modulus do you have in the left?
We'll talk about that later.
Is that the network of bundles?
That is the left one or the right one? So the right one is a network of bundles. Yes.
And
the left one is a network of bundles, but I think, yes. The bundles grow as you increase the amount of bundling protein, but I think this protein also acts as a sort of a cross-linker too of actin filaments. So it does both. We don't know. We want other people to think about it.
What was the upshot from the bead surface?
Okay, let's go back to that one now that you sort of understand what's going on. The BSA beads are sticky, even though their sort of patchiness is sticky. So they're sort of stuck to this network. So even though the pore size is getting bigger, they're really stuck to the thick bundles. So as you... Yeah, it's because the BSA is just sort of sticking to the carboxylate groups, and there's sort of areas where it's only partially working.
So if without
anything else. Oh, the network, they don't move at all. The network sort of just, it doesn't form. Yeah.
This is the same actin that you usually use, mm-hmm. only in the isolated screw.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's just, and we've noticed this with other actin binding proteins too, like fimbrin. We've seen it with fibrin networks as well. What other things? We've seen it with a lot of actin itself doesn't bind so much, but the binding proteins and other proteins really do bind a lot. And then the unsticky beads, they sort of just diffuse the network. They're measuring like a cage size. So at low amounts of cross screwin, the cage size doesn't change very much. And as you increase the amount, the bundles get bigger and the voids there's more space for the beads to move around. So you're measuring sort of a cage size here. And sort of this is, so these are the techniques. We have like 100 particles in our field of view, and it's a great way of looking at heterogeneous materials. And so we want to sort of use these techniques to directly map local mechanical structure of individual beads to the structure of the polymer network. And we are working with other cross-linkers and bundling proteins. And I mean, this is sort of an example of one of the networks we work with, alpha actinin. And this one at high amounts of alpha actinin, I mean, there's cracks forming in the sample. There's places where the beads just diffuse over, you know, hundreds of microns. And, you know, the cracks are actually like probably thousands of microns long. And how do these heterogeneities form? You know, what are the mechanical properties? What's giving rise to the bulk rheology that we see in the networks? And so using microrheology, we can do two-particle microrheology. I sort of like using the unsticky beads because I don't know how they're locally modifying the structure. And so these are the PEG beads. From the one-particle motions of two different actin screw-in concentrations, we don't see any differences in the one-particle motion. And with the two-particle, we do see a difference in their plateau modulus. And Maria will talk about that, about how that relates to the sort of the bulk modulus and their...
The values for right there,
0.3. Yeah, 0.3 pascals and 0.8. So, here.
Question.
Yes?
Just a number. What are you going to do with plateau modulus, 1 milligram per milliliter actin?
It's like 0.1. Yeah.
Well, that was Ackman's data. Oh, yeah.
I'm not sure we have
this room. Okay. We actually don't have that much from the boat. We're not going to show that much today. We can talk about it more later.
You could also continue.
Okay. Well, what would people rather do?
No.
Okay. So this is the bulk rheology that we did on the actin screw-in networks, the same sort of cross-linker and actin concentrations that Margaret just showed for the bulk for the microrheology. And we did the experiments in a stress-controlled rheometer and a parallel plate geometry at 40 millimeter diameter and at 100 micron gap. So we're really trying to get the most that we could out of the machine. So we tried to maximize the surface area and go to small gap because they were biological samples and we're really limited in the amount of sample. So we're really happy that we could do these experiments at all. And the sample volume was around 300 microliters that we used. And the way that we did the experiments, the way that we prepared the sample was in the rheometer at pre-cooled at 10 degrees Celsius to minimize evaporation of the sample. And the polymerization occurred in the presence of the cross-linking protein. Or the bundling protein, the screw-in, which has both.
Do you do anything with the surfaces, the free surfaces?
We haven't roughened these surfaces. We were talking about that yesterday. So
Nothing plates. Zachman keeps insisting that one has to do something about the free surfaces,
right?
To avoid some sort of network forming on the surface.
We didn't do that. Zachman, what they did was, I think they put a surfactant around, or actually some lipids. And they just formed a monolayer around it.
The problem used to be that if you put G-actin in there, it gave you a shear modulus. And that went away with a lipid added. So did you ever try G-actin and see if it gives you some kind of surface effect?
Just pure actin?
Without polymerizing, without magnesium.
No, I don't think we can do it.
Is that because of protein denatures
of
the air interface?
Right, that's the problem. Then you get a film of sort of you know, stiff protein on the air.
You just wouldn't be able to measure
that. The answer is you haven't tried.
Yeah.
But here, because it's a cross-link network, it's not, I don't think we can worry about the modulus.
Because the modulus is higher, yeah.
Yeah.
Do you polymerize your systems in situ, in the rheometer?
In situ, in the rheometer.
After it has been loaded?
Just load it, let it polymerize, and it would wait an hour.
The polymerization is slow enough that you can do that.
Well, it only takes a few seconds to actually put the sample in and bring the tool down.
It takes 20 minutes for like an active network to not 20 minutes, like 5 minutes. Sorry. But it's short, it's longer than...
Much longer than
But if you look at just with microrheology, you can see the beads sort of diffuse around up to about 5 minutes. And then they reach their minimal motions around 5 to 10. It's probably still polarizing. We wait longer than that.
Right.
But for loading the tool issues, it's not a problem.
But doesn't that mean that possibly they end up in those parts of the network which are less dense?
They might, yeah. But 2B should get rid of that.
Not if you're always
not
in the
not necessarily. Yeah, that's true.
So all these experiments.
Don't forget that you don't necessarily have to average over all beads the same way. That's the whole point. You can look at different regions if you want. I think that these things are going to be really excluded from where you get these really sharp, really dense networks.
I mean, the 2-bead always makes sense. It's just a comparison to the macroscopic thing.
No, I'm not sure that the 2-bead even is going to make sense when you see the heterogeneities like in that alpha actinum. You see these really heterogeneous. My analogy is always what you're ending up, you're measuring a modulus of this building. And do we measure modulus if I walk around in this room, the modulus of the building? If I walk around in this room and you walk around in that room, can we measure the modulus of the building? That's going to be really tough. How do you do it? You shake the building, right? You put an earthquake on and you shake the building. And that's what the bulk rheology is doing. But that's really, you know, that's really what this micro phase separation is. Beginning to look very much like that. And you put this huge amount of phosphine.
So all of these, so when we vary the amount of crosslinker, we've actually always got quite a bit of crosslinker in there compared to the monomer. So we're starting at 30 monomers to one crosslinker, and then we go up from there. So here's an example of what we see in the bulk rheology. This is at 10 monomers per screwing. And the solid symbols are G prime, and the open symbols are G double prime. That's a frequency dependence. The blue symbols are at 5% strain, and then we did the 2% strain experiment all the way down to low frequencies. And we see a true plateau modulus, and it's really an elastic solid that we're measuring. The viscosity of this is around, you can see around 0.5 Pascal seconds. So it's not the viscosity of the fluid. This doesn't correspond to the buffer.
In which direction are you measuring? From high to low?
From high to low.
So is the effect that it goes up there, is that just polarization keeps on going during your measurement? Because your prime should never go up in that direction. It's physically impossible for a system.
You get that or drawing.
Okay.
Yeah, we don't know what that means.
You go if you scan backwards, is it reproducible?
Yeah, it is reproducible. So we don't really know what that low frequency is.
Yeah.
That's
nice. Quite a lot.
It is quite a lot.
Sorry, what was the concentration of that?
So, this is at 0.5 milligrams per milliliter. Active. 0.5 milligrams per milliliter. And here's how it matches up with the 2-point microrheology. And this is a 15-to-1 sample that's G actin to screw-in. And the G prime matches up really well in that. G double prime doesn't match up so well, but that's the one that's much less. So what we really believe is G prime. Did you want to say anything else about the matchup to 2-point?
Is that a sample that's, how heterogeneous is that sample in the microscopy?
It's not so heterogeneous. So the heterogeneity start to form in the screw-in samples around 5-to-1.
I see. It's actually a rather low
modulus that you expect.
Yeah, I mean, that is when Jenny accidentally cross-linked actin, usually got modulated 10 or 100 times that, and now you're putting in cross-links on purpose.
But this is still almost an order of magnitude above what you expect for a half milligram milliliter.
Right, but it's nowhere near what you get when you know something's cross-linked usually.
So it could be, you could imagine it's bundling and not forming crosslinks, and it's not clear that it's going to increase the modulus to the degree that you might expect if you're only forming crosslinks.
It looks like it's somewhat bundled already.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, it's really a bundling
protein. And so we do this for several samples. So we, at the 0.5 milligrams per milliliter sample, we did different samples where we changed the amount of crosslinker relative to the monomer concentration. And we also, at one monomer to screwing ratio, we changed the actin concentration. And so here's what we saw for the plateau modulus. As we increased the amount of screw-in, we saw the plateau modulus increase in these samples. We should say something about sample variability, because we did see, so this is 30 to 1 actin to screw-in. This is 15 to 1, this is 5 to 1, and this is 2.5 to 1. So 2.5 screw-in for every, 2.5 actin monomers per screw-in. And for, it was for the 5 to 1 sample, we saw that this we did three different samples at 5 to 1, and we did see that the sample could vary from 2 pascals up to 6 pascals. So that was in, we saw two samples that were very close, and one sample was an outlier. So we do, we should say something about reproducibility. But this was a definite trend that we saw. It clearly increases with the amount of screwing in there. And at one actin to screw-in ratio, as we increase the concentration of actin, we clearly see the plateau modulus increase as well.
The dependence is strange, because you screwed up a little bit. The axis is a bit odd, isn't it? The zero of the y-axis is slightly
right.
Right. So it's actually, the dependence is much weaker than it appears to be there. So,
well, it's just here. This is not a log-log plot.
Right hand, the right hand.
Yeah.
We don't know what we expect for.
Oh, so both axes are funny. So I could put a straight line through there in my. So like, the origins is not clear.
Right. Yeah, so. Do this quickly. So the nice thing about this test, so before we were doing the linear viscoelastic test in order to get out G prime and G double prime, so we're just going like this at and varying the frequency. But in the bulk rheology, we can also do the nonlinear test where we, at one frequency, increase the strain. And so we can really go into the nonlinear regime when we do that. And so these tests were done at a frequency of 0.1 hertz, so we're down in the plateau range for the frequency. And as we increase the strain, we see the modulus does this. If we do it again, the modulus comes up. So as we increase the strain, it doesn't just break, it actually gets stronger first. And we could go up and go back down. And then finally we break the sample, so we go beyond. So that's an example of strain hardening. And we, if we waited a while, the modulus could come back up, but it never came up to where it was before. So the screw-in is dynamic, so it can rebuild the network to some degree, but it never came back up to where it did before. And then it also strain hardens a bit later in strain, and it doesn't strain harden to the same degree.
Have you sense of how much of that is disturbing the actin, and how much of it's disturbing the cross-linking? I mean, you could also be breaking actin.
Yeah, we don't know. We don't have pictures of this.
Do you know what is the binding energy of the screw-in?
I don't know. I think it's not as dynamic as like say alpha actinin. So it's as far as I know, it's sort of, I don't know what in particular KT, it's pretty static, so it sort of sticks and then it.
Can you put screw-in on an AFN and pull it from actin?
Oh, that doesn't tell you energy either. Force business, not sure if it's around.
You can integrate from a large distance, and this will give you the energy.
Yeah, this is time scale question always. If you pull fastest, you need a larger force.
So you did that, you do it very slow, but if you get some.
But then it falls off anyway, so it's a long discussion there, then go on. How you test the energy landscape. So I think here, the energy you really get out of binding constants. And if the binding constant is micromolar, so what I guess the point is, then it should be many KTs.
You can't pull anything when slowly on something and then try to pull off because it just jumps at some point. So the problem is you can't integrate over the whole energy.
So we just got these results, and so we're happy to show them here and have everyone think about them, because we see this interesting strain hardening. We do it for different samples, and as we increase the amount of screw-in, we see the strain hardening set in earlier, and we can always come up and come back down as long as we didn't break the sample. And once we did, the modulus just dropped. And so here's what we see for the critical strain. So this is, at what point does it break as we increase the amount of screw in, or if we have a certain amount of screw in it, as we increase the actin concentration. And as you might expect, as you increase, because we saw the modulus go up, so maybe we're making a more brittle network. So the point at which it breaks moves in earlier as we increase the amount of screw in there.
Can I go back one step? I'd just like to point out that that strain learning curve, if you compare it to random networks that are purely synthetic, say made of colloidal aggregates, you see a much sharper break. When it breaks, everything breaks. But here, you know, it looks like it comes down a bit. I think that if you go partway down and then go back, you get another strain hardening curve up to that. So it looks like you're breaking different parts of the network at different amounts of strain, which is different than sort of simple model networks that at least I've seen.
It's maybe due to the fact that you concentrate the portions or parts.
Yeah, I mean, that's just a very, very heterogeneous. If you ask where the force is transmitted, the stress changes, or whatever you
call it, localized, yeah.
Yeah, could be really, but that says it's really heterogeneous.
And this looks like further evidence that this is bundling more than cross-linking, because if the strain rotens at a much higher strain than lightly cross-linked actin.
It goes
in the same direction. That is, if you have very few of the screw in molecules are acting as cross links, and most of them as bundlers, then it means you've actually got a rather long distance between cross links, which would give you strain hardening at reasonable strains.
Why is it rather long distance?
In order to get a strain hardening at a strain
longer.
What?
I want it in
micron. Longer than entanglement?
In order to get strain hardening at a strain of order one, it has to be order of persistence now, which is what Jeremy sees in the mountain. And I thought, who knows what the persistence length of one of these bundles is.
It's large. Mm-hmm. You go back and look at the pictures and you get some idea of what the size of the meshes are.
It could be often that on the heterogeneity, the weak points are the more dilute regimes, so where you have much smaller bundles.
Could be. The fact that two-particle and macroscopic rheology agree suggests that they say that it's not so heterogeneous in these samples.
That was at 15 to 1.
Oh.
No, it's not different. This is 30 to 1, so it's in the middle.
At what frequency is this?
That's at 0.1. Here.
Okay. Because if you probe it at different frequencies, of course, if it really is dynamic cross-linking, you could possibly see that.
Right.
I don't think we saw dynamic.
We
didn't see a difference with the 0.1.
We didn't see a difference. At 0.1 hertz between 1, so at 1 hertz and 0.1 hertz, if you go to a lower frequency, it moved it out a little bit. So it strained a little later, but it wasn't anything significant. But what we can do is go up to really high frequencies, like 7. Yeah.
Did I hear you say that after you disrupted the network by the shear in this way, that however long you waited, it never seemed to recover?
In one sample, it did recover completely.
How long did that take?
That was 1 hour.
Yeah.
1 hour after we broke it.
Was that a particular sample? In particular, do you understand why it was that sample? Sure. Was that identical with other samples that didn't?
It was prepared in the same way.
Okay.
It was the same. It was one of the 15 to 1 samples.
Yeah.
And they always came up some, but never the entire.
Remember, it's quite an action that the actual humans can be dynamic as well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, well,
you can actually get to
the
form elsewhere.
Yeah. Did you ever see, was it always true that on its way to equilibrium, the effective modulus was less than the equilibrium model? Did you ever see systems where you
could jump
on its way back in actually crystallized systems?
That actually came above the original modulus?
Yeah.
We did see it, but because we weren't doing anything special at the interface, we couldn't be sure if our sample was drying or if chemicals were coming.
We've seen that effect in some of the alloy type beta sheets, for example, several networks that we work with. You do the same thing,
you break the thing apart, and then it's all just, it's got these effects and this condition. And the first thing that happens is it's really from there to dabbling bits, and everyone joins hands rapidly. And actually, what it seems to be, you can form a temporary, very dense, brittle, high modulus network as an immediate recovery stage on the way to. long time. I think the result you get. So this might emerge from the microstructure rather than someone.
Okay. So it could be. What does that mean? You're actually, when you break it or when you strain it a lot, you're actually mixing things.
Bones. You know, you've got these big bundles. You tore the thing apart with shear at the local scale. You could have splays in a bundle which is fibrillated with the end or something. If very high shear, you might introduce defects of all manner like that. In which case, when these bundles see each other, they can form all sorts of little cross-link structures which increase the effective cross-link density. Well, this is our picture of what happens in the aggregate triples, analog triples. Anyway. It's a wild, stupid conjecture, but I'm wondering, there are similarities between all these self-assembled biological systems, and there seems to be like each of which emerges from time to time.
Okay. Well, we actually don't know what to expect, whether it should come up or not.
Yeah.
It should come up to some degree because it's dynamic.
But I mean, don't necessarily throw away data that does that.
Okay.
You know, you're thinking it's probably just, you know, dunk on the outside. It might be dunk on the outside. Our stuff might be dunk on the outside.
So, done that. So what we also did, just quickly, just look at, well, how much is it strain hardening? So what is the peak here relative to the plateau modulus? So, and in the, as we increase the amount of screwing in there, we actually see, well, at the 30th one and the 15th one, it comes up, but then it actually decreases. And that's real. I'll show you the strain hardening for that. We think that that's real. And what's happening is that maybe it's because it's more heterogeneous. It starts to strain harden earlier, but it also is a shallower maximum, if you will. And here's the data for that. So this is the highest degree of screwing in there that we had. So we start to break the sample, and it's much shallower than the strain hardening that we saw in the other. So we think that that's more heterogeneous, and we can do the same test again, and strain hardens a bit later, but we've completely broken it at this point. And if we wait a bit, we can actually see it strain harden again to a much less degree, and then we break it. So the conclusions that we draw from this are that the plateau modulus clearly increases with screwing concentration. It also increases as we increase the G-actin concentration. The critical strain clearly occurs earlier with increasing screwing concentration, and also occurs earlier with increasing actin concentration. And so we want everyone to think about this. That's it.